From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, comedian Mike E. Winfield from the Coexist Comedy Tour, plus filmmaker Larry Brand, who's in town shooting a documentary about Coexist. Also, author Eva Rutland and her novel No Crystal Stair, about discrimination faced by an upper-middle-class black family in Atlanta. And the new conductor of Music in the Mountains. Last year, Gregory Voida had the chance to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic, arguably the world's greatest orchestra. First, thousands of people will run the California International Marathon this weekend. Watching out for all those runners is a large medical team assembled by Kaiser Permanente. The two co-medical directors join us. They are Dr. Meredith Bean and Dr. Kathy Norbutis. Meredith is a sports medicine specialist. Kathy is an emergency room doctor. They're both at Kaiser South Sacramento. Meredith, Kathy, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
What does that mean, being co-medical director or medical director in general of the marathon? Meredith, what does that mean you have to do?
Well, it means we're in charge of the health of the runners who are participating in the marathon. We have to cover the course, make sure they're okay, and attend to them if they need us.
And how serious are those health concerns? Do you have reason to be concerned about the health of the people who are running?
Well, there is an increased risk of some medical problems while you're participating in a marathon, but generally they're minor. But there are rare occasions where serious consequences can occur.
I see. Well, let's start with the serious ones. Kathy, what kind of serious medical problems can people have while they're running a marathon?
Well, probably the most serious consequence would be the rare occurrence of a cardiac arrest or cardiac abnormality while you're running. This is pretty rare, but we are prepared to handle that if that does happen in the race. We have medical providers all throughout the course at every aid station on the course. So there's 18 aid stations, so we'll have medical providers out there, as well as having medics on bikes with AEDs and emergency equipment if needed. So, of course, this is the worst case scenario. And in my job, I think about the worst case scenario. So we prepare for that, but always hope that nothing like this ever happens.
Have you heard of people dying in a marathon?
Yes, and actually recently there's been quite a few deaths, and Meredith will talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Meredith?
Yes, so generally the accepted death rate in a marathon, or the statistics show that there's one death per 50 to 75,000 marathon runners.
Oh, wow.
However, this fall there's been a little bit of spike in that rate. There have been about 7 deaths in people participating in half marathons and marathons in the United States.
And what happened? Any reason you know of for the spike?
We actually don't know the reason, and it may not be a huge spike. What happens is they do get a lot of media attention because it has unfortunately happened in younger individuals where you wouldn't anticipate something like this necessarily. They haven't really talked about the exact causes except in an older individual where it was an underlying cardiac problem.
Were those cardiac problems in the younger people?
That would be suspicious for a cardiac problem, but the autopsies thus far are inconclusive.
Really? Okay. Well, my guests are the co-medical directors of the California International Marathon, Dr. Meredith Bean and Dr. Kathy Norbutis. They both work for Kaiser Permanente and in the South Sacramento facility. Kathy, let's talk about the more mundane medical problems that can happen. What kind of things are you looking out for in the runners?
Well, probably the most common thing are blisters and abrasions. You know, with that many people running a marathon, especially at the beginning, people can trip and fall and skin their knee or hurt their arms or their hands. So we'll take care of those on the course as they happen, as well as blisters. People develop blisters while they run, and we have all the equipment needed to handle that on the course.
How many people in the medical team?
There's over 100. We have over 100 medical volunteers this year.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Last year was the first year that we did this for this event, and we have a lot of returning volunteers as well as even more. So over 100 volunteers out there.
Meredith, as far as you know, is it normal for a marathon of this size, I think about 7,500 runners, to have a medical team of 100 or so people?
Well, you generally... It varies on the course or the route of the marathon. This marathon is unique in that it actually traverses 26 straight miles, so we need a lot of people to cover that distance. Other marathons may loop around and can have aid stations double up on each other.
I see. Now, the weather, of course, can always be an issue with the California International Marathon because it happens in December. Now, there's a big storm coming in, according to the weather people. But the last I heard, the weather's expected to be clear, cold, and nearly still on Sunday morning when the marathon's happening. Kathy, what does that tell you? Does that cause for concern as a doctor who's going to be watching out for people? Or is that good news?
It's pretty good news. What would be worse is rain and even colder temperatures. Last year was actually quite cold. What was interesting last year is it actually started out warmer and ended colder. So it got actually colder in the morning, which was a tough situation because people started, you know, shedding clothes and getting down to the finish, they start slowing down, so they got a lot colder. So we're going to have a close eye out for any hypothermia this year, given the cold temperatures.
Meredith, people, of course, are responsible for their own well-being when it comes down to it. But still, as a medical director of a marathon, how do you handle situations where you see someone and you believe or know that they're in medical distress, but they are just waving people off and going, no, I'm going to make it to the finish line?
Well, that can be a very challenging situation, which we did encounter at times last year. We've instructed our volunteers, if they believe that medically speaking this person should not continue with the race, they're to advise them of such, tell them of the risks. You can't tackle them and hold them down. But we do have, as well as the stations on course, we have medics and some physicians on bikes. And so they can kind of go along with the runner, and we have communication that they can go along with the runner and make sure they're okay.
Yeah. Kathy, what kind of equipment do you have there? Does it correspond in any way to what you have in your emergency room?
Somewhat. I mean, for this event, what we're mostly going to be doing is first aid, and if there's anybody that needs higher level of care, we're going to transfer them to a hospital. But we do have the ability to intervene. We have AEDs, which are defibrillators. So those have been shown to increase the chance of survival if anybody does have a cardiac arrest. And we'll have a good number of those out on the course, so they're readily available and quickly available if needed for the whole 26 miles.
My guests, co-medical directors of the California International Marathon, they're both from Kaiser, Dr. Meredith Bean and Dr. Kathy Norbutis. Have either of you been runners of marathons or anything like that?
I have. I've run a few many years ago.
Yeah?
So, yeah.
Kathy's a little shy, but she was a runner in college.
Ah, I see. Yeah. Why did you stop running?
Oh, I haven't really stopped. It's just I've had other things come into my life that have taken more time than running.
Yeah, sure. But when you watch the runners in the marathon, I guess you probably have a better idea of what they're going through, perhaps, than someone who is a doctor but hasn't run a marathon.
Yeah, that's true. I can see kind of what their goals are and what they're going through and the mental challenge as well as the physical challenge that's involved in running a marathon. So I think I do have an understanding and kind of feel for them when they're out there. So
how do you mean feel for them?
When they hit certain marks along the course and you make certain goals, you can get that sense of pride and that sense of excitement. And then when you also see the struggles and the push and the just, you know, how it takes the whole body to get through to the finish line, I feel for them for that too.
I've never run a marathon, but I've often heard about this wall that people often hit, or maybe even mm-hmm. always hit mm-hmm. at some point in a marathon. Mm-hmm. Do people always hit a wall?
Most do at some point, whether it's a big wall or a little wall. There's some hurdles to overcome throughout the course, and typically it happens at a certain mileage point in the course, but it can happen anywhere for anybody.
And what is the wall?
Well, it's where, you know, you've trained to a certain point and you get to that mileage on the course, and then suddenly your body just wants to shut down. Your body and your mind just want to just stop. So it takes that extra effort to push through and to get through. Unfortunately, at Loman's Plaza is where many people hit the wall, and we have a huge medical tent set up there, as well as a band playing and lots of people out there to cheer people on to get them through that tough part in the course.
Loman's Plaza, for people who are listening to our show but not in Sacramento, is a shopping center on Fair Oaks Boulevard. I'm guessing it's probably about 20 miles into the marathon. So you've run a good portion of the marathon, but there's still quite a long way to go. Is that part of the issue, that you've come a long way, but you've still got a long way to go?
Yes, exactly.
Well, this comes back to a question from earlier. Meredith, how do you know when you're dealing with just this temporary wall that people are going through, and whether they're going through something more serious?
That's a really good question, something we're trying to train our volunteers to pick out. So really it's about mental status. If someone's confused, it can be a sign of an underlying more serious problem. But if they're just tired and fatigued, it's usually that they've depleted their glycogen stores in their muscle and they just don't have that fuel anymore, which is not dangerous per se.
And Meredith, have you had any serious running experience?
I do run recreationally, but played other sports.
Yeah. Now, you're a sports medicine specialist. Any thoughts for people who haven't run marathons but might do it in the future, but from a medical perspective?
Well, one of the things in terms of potentially preventing an adverse outcome is if you have any cardiac risk factors, it's very important that you see your physician and have an evaluation to make sure this would be safe for you to undertake. For people without risk factors, it's good to go with a well-known training program and just follow those guidelines. And it's a very slow ramp up. I recommend that people just be running regularly at shorter distances before they embark on training for a marathon.
Kathy, how does that sound to you?
That sounds good. I would also add that if you ever have any symptoms while running, whether it be chest pain or shortness of breath that's beyond what you should be feeling, that you stop and you get checked out. And even on the course, if you feel something's not right, look for one of our medical personnel. We're going to be out there in full force. We'll be wearing a red shirt with a cross on it. And, you know, stop and talk to any of us on the course and we'll be able to take care of you. So listen to your body. It's basically the answer.
Well, we've been talking about the California International Marathon. It happens this Sunday morning from Folsom to downtown Sacramento. The weather forecast is looking pretty good, at least dry for the marathon, but I guess everyone's going to be crossing their fingers in that respect. My guests were the co-medical directors, both doctors at Kaiser Permanente in the South Sacramento facility. Dr. Meredith Bean is a sports medicine specialist. Dr. Kathy Norbutis is an emergency room doctor. Thank you both so much and best wishes for the marathon.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, author Eva Rutland. Her novel, No Crystal Stair, draws from her early experience as a black mother in an otherwise white neighborhood. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Coming up on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, atom smashing resumes at the huge particle collider in Switzerland. You'll get an update. Also, how NASA is trying to free a trapped rover on the surface of Mars. Plus, a look at life below the surface of the Earth. And how scientifically grounded is the research quoted by your therapist? That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. No Crystal Stair is a novel by Sacramento author Eva Rutland, inspired by her own life as a middle-class black woman raised in Atlanta who moved to California. Eva Rutland is also the author of many romance novels and the award-winning memoir When We Were Colored. The new edition of No Crystal Stair was put out by the publishing company Eva Rutland co-founded with her daughter, Ginger Rutland, an editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. They both join us. Eva, Ginger, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Just so people understand, Eva doesn't hear so well, but we're happy to have her with us. So
so she'll do the best she can.
Indeed. Eva, why could you explain the title, please? No Crystal Stair. What does that mean?
That life is not quite a crystal stair. It has a few problems, and you just have to meet it as you travel along.
Yes.
It also comes from a famous poem by Langston Hughes. He wrote a poem that went something like, "Life for me ain't been no crystal stair." That means it's been difficult. There are places where the carpet is worn bare, as he says in the poem. The poem is actually called Mother to Son, and it's the story of a black mother talking to her son, trying to tell the son, life isn't easy, but you have to keep going no matter what the problems are.
Yes. Well, Eva also doesn't see, so I'm not sure how familiar you are with the photograph on the front of the book, but it's a great photograph, I guess, of you.
Well, thank you. Yes, it is of me. You're making me feel very good.
Could you tell us when this photograph was taken and where?
Where was it? Oh, I think it was taken at the black newspaper place in Atlanta, wasn't it?
Yes. It was taken at actually at the home.
It was advertised. I was engaged, and they put an article in the paper, and I think that's when they took my picture.
Yeah?
That's exactly right. She's 26 in that picture. And she looks, I think, sort of like Halle Berry, only better.
Yeah, yes, I agree.
I wish I did.
Well, you still look good, Eva, I've got to say.
Well, thank you.
Ginger, did you choose the photograph?
Yeah, this is. I am in the middle of an enterprise that's really sort of difficult for me and new for me, which is I started a publishing company to republish my mother's books. As you noted, she's written about 25 novels, most of them Harlequin romance novels. This particular romance, No Crystal Stair, is her own story. It's a fictionalized account of her life. But much of what happens in this book actually happened to her.
Eva, you've also written a memoir, and you've got this book that is a fictionalized version of your life. Which did you write first, this novel or the memoir?
Oh, the memoir was the first book I'd ever. I wasn't going to be a writer. I was going to be an accountant. And I moved from Atlanta to
Tuskegee.
Tuskegee. And when my children were born, we moved to Ohio. And it was years of integration, when they were just beginning to integrate. And I'd been from I'd been from Georgia. And I was a little frightened for my children. And they were getting ready to go to the integrated schools. And I knew how they would be treated. And so I began to write a few articles. I sent them to
Ladies' Home Journal.
Ladies' Home Journal and
Woman's Day.
Woman's Day. And I wanted to tell white women to be kind to my children. They are just as precious as yours. And so those articles were published. And it made it much easier for me much easier for my children. Integration was a new thing.
Yes.
And they needed people to understand and to treat them just like everybody else. They were just as precious.
Ginger, you were one of those children. You are one of those children.
Yes.
Did your mother's efforts pay off?
You know, when I was a kid, my mother was writing, but I wasn't paying much attention. Like every kid, I'm sort of self-absorbed. It was only as I got to be an adult, and actually as my mother got older and started living with me, that I realized how important what she was writing was about. The first book, which we called When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, originally when it was published in the 60s, it was called The Trouble with Being a Mama. That is really the story, a sweeping story of life in America at an important changing time in America, as we went from a segregated world in which blacks had very few rights to a slowly integrating world. And she chronicles the real life experiences of black, middle-class black Americans.
My guests are Eva Rutland, the author, and her daughter Ginger Rutland. Ginger is heading up the republication of Eva's many books. The most recent is the re-edition of the novel, fictionalized memoir in a sense, called No Crystal Stair. And by the way, Eva and Ginger will be at Time Tested Books this Saturday evening. The publishing company is called IWP, which stands for Isaac Westmoreland.
Publishing, yes.
Publishing, yes. But the IW is Isaac. Now, Isaac was your grandfather, Eva, correct?
Yes, I remember him. He died when I was about 3 years old, but I do remember him.
Well, there's a photograph of him on the website for the publishing company, and he's a very distinguished-looking man. Could you tell us about him?
He was a shoemaker, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but I heard that he was the son of his owner. So that he was half white and half black, I guess. But he learned to make shoes, and he was freed several years before when was he freed?
After the Civil War.
After the Civil War. And he owned a shoe shop, and he was making boots and shoes in Atlanta. and he lived right down in the middle of town until they had that terrible riot in 1906, I think. And he was he had 11 children, and he's 9 of them lived long enough to go to college, and all of those 9 finished college.
That must have been remarkable for him, having been born a slave.
It must have been, but he was evidently a very smart man, and he certainly did send all of his children to the college and took very good care of them. And
my mother was born in the house that he built about 6 years after slavery and was raised in that house. And what I think is her parents' generation was they were the first generation of blacks in my family born outside of slavery. And yet they were able to go to college. Many of them became professionals, dentists, businessmen, insurance executives, pharmacist, and that sort of thing. And I don't think there is much written today about this middle class or upper middle class cadre of blacks that existed during that time.
I don't think people realize that black people were smart, very smart. They were doing all the work when they were slaves. So that when they were free, it was easier for them to enter the professions. They were used to working and learning.
Eva, you've spent decades and made a good life for yourself in Sacramento, but you're from Atlanta. Did you ever wonder what life would have been like if you'd stayed in Atlanta?
Atlanta's a wonderful place. I had a wonderful life there. Though there is black people have a life of their own. And I was a little afraid to leave it. It was integrated, and we had parties. And, I had my debut there from college, and I had birthday parties there. I had a wonderful life in Atlanta, even though the house that my grandfather built was in the middle of a white neighborhood, mostly poor whites who came in during the Depression. And there were 4 or 5 families in houses that were built for one family. So there were problems as well as pleasures there. But it did teach me that there was no difference in people. White people were just like black people, and I realized that it didn't matter what you were or who you were, that it was you, you know. And I think I lived a wonderful life. I'd rather want to live on Auburn Avenue or on the west side where the black people lived. But I think it was very fortunate that I lived in a house where there were many poor white people around me, and I learned that people are people, no different, and it was a wonderful life.
Eva, why did you choose to focus on writing romance novels?
I liked romance novels. You know, when I was a little girl, my mother was very close to the people who had the drugstore in Atlanta. And they would get these little magazines where they had stories, you know, love stories. And that's what I liked to read and write. So I would read those stories when I was a little girl. And I never thought I was going to be a writer, but I should have been. I should have known I was going to write. Anyway, I enjoyed those stories, and
yes.
Wow, what was the question?
You've answered it. You've answered it. Ginger, this must be quite a personally important project for you to be setting up this publishing house to republish all these books by your mother.
It's a real pleasure. Most people go around talking about their son, the this, or their daughter, the that, the doctor, the lawyer, the editor-in-chief. I spend much of my day talking about my mother, the writer. And I am extremely proud of her. She's a very good writer. In fact, I work for the Sacramento Bee, and I'm a journalist, and often there are times I call her because I'm missing a word or I can't express exactly what I want to see, and she can help me. So I admire her her abilities, and it is fun.
Yeah.
She's more interested in what is happening now, and I'm more interested in my romances, which she hadn't even published.
Are they going to come?
They are going to come. I tell you, being a publisher, you never. I now am very sympathetic to the business people, and I understand how difficult it is. Just the business of publishing is difficult. For example, you have to have for every book an ISBN number, which is this little number that the Library of Congress demands on every book. How do you get that ISBN number? Who do you go to? You have to decide things like the cover. You have to decide, you know, what's going to be on the cover, what's picture to use. You go through a zillion pictures. You have to figure out the design inside.
Choose the font.
Yeah, choose the font. Choose the font size. Choose where are you going to put the numbering on the page. Is it going to be at the top of the page? Is it going to be on the bottom right-hand side of the page? Every one of these decisions has to be made. How are you going to design the spine of the book, right? What's going to be on the spine? You have to go out and find people who will say nice things at the book, the little blurbs that you see on the back of the book from Library Journal or Gwendolyn Osborne, the Romance Reader, or the Spelman Messenger. All of those things, you as a publisher have to go out and figure it out and find people and get their permission to say nice things about the book.
So the book has to be something you believe there's a market for.
Yes. And then you have to figure out how to pay for it. That's the other big thing.
And I'm glad she takes care of all the business, because all I have to do is tell a story.
That's Eva Rutland, author. There's a new edition of her novel, No Crystal Stair. And she and her daughter, Ginger Rutland, well known for her work as editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee, and also she contributes to Capital Public Radio every Friday morning, and the publisher of Eva's books. You can meet Eva and Ginger at Midtown Sacramento's Time-Tested Books this Saturday, December 5th at 7 p.m. Eva, Ginger, pleasure to talk with you both again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, comedian Mike E. Winfield. He's a Christian in the Coexist comedy tour. Also, filmmaker Larry Brand, who's making a documentary about Coexist. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check our archives at capradio.org/insight. Next week, on Monday, how regenerative medicine might help HIV patients by inserting anti-HIV genes into human cells. On Tuesday, you'll hear an unusual high school band. They play the blues. And on Thursday, a local journalist's new book about how Barack Obama thinks. The Coexist Comedy Tour is back in its hometown of Sacramento with a show this Saturday night. Coexist includes comedians from several religious faiths and an atheist, hence the name. The group's Christian comedian is Mike E. Winfield, and he joins us along with filmmaker Larry Brand, who's in town making a documentary about Coexist. Mike, Larry, welcome to Insight.
Hey, how are you?
In the building!
You are in the building.
Can you tell which one of us is the comedian?
Mike, how did you become the Christian comedian in Coexist? Because you weren't the first Christian.
No, I wasn't the first Christian.
You weren't the first Christian, period, but you also weren't the first Christian in Coexist.
Oh, no. Yeah, it just kind of happened, you know, like the other guy, I guess he lost faith, fell off the boat, and then... And
that's true. He actually did.
Fall off the boat.
Yeah. So are you worried that might happen to you?
Am I worried? Well, there's a lot of demonic forces in the air, but I don't think they're going to get a hold of me. So,
Do you do comedy about your faith when you're being Mike E. Winfield, stand-up comedian? Is that part of what you do otherwise, or is this a different act you do in Coexist?
I do it both. Like, for me, comedy is based on my life. And Jesus is a part of my life. So he's in the act, whether it's on stage at another show, Mikey Winfield, or if it's coexists Mikey Winfield, or if it's just, you know, Thursday morning, you know, it's just it's going to be a part of it somewhere.
Were you raised Christian?
Man, you know, I was, but it's like my mom was just, it was more based on just spiritual. It was just basic, just believe in God. It wasn't quite concentrated.
There's a lot of comedy is pretty raunchy. Where do you stand on that?
You know what? I'm not a raunchy comedian, but I do see both sides. Like, I see, like, people are put in certain places to enlighten people's lives, and you can enlighten it on a raunchy side as well as, like, a clean side. But I wouldn't say I was raunchy by no means.
My guest is Mike E. Winfield, one of the comedians in the Coexist Comedy Tour. He's the Christian in the group. Coexist performs this Saturday night at Sacramento's Crest Theatre. Mike, you got an open book with a pencil. And Are you reading notes or are you going to make notes?
Yeah, I'm making notes. I'm trying to see what happens here and see what
to see if you get an idea for a joke.
Well, I write all day long, but I'm really excited to get people to come to the show because even though, like, we have our acts and everything, like, it's a live performance. Anything can happen. And I've been a part of those times when anything happens.
One of your bits I've seen on your MySpace page is where you talk about your big-ass teeth.
Right. Oh, you can say big-ass? Okay.
Well,
right.
I don't know. We'll just find out. My boss is off sick today, so that's why I'm saying words like
right,
that.
All right. This will be the last day for this show, huh?
I guess so. And you say that that because of your teeth, people think you're smiling all the time.
Right.
But you do smile a lot.
Yeah, it looks like I'm smiling because the teeth are big, but it's just they're not. It's just when I close my mouth, it's uncomfortable. So it just... Yeah. You know what I hate? Other people can't see it. I hate windy days.
Because?
My gums get dry. That's more for in the studio, right?
Well, our studio is cold. Now, also with us is Larry. Larry Brand, why are you making a film about Coexist?
Well, you know, you're getting a Christian, an atheist, a Muslim, a Jew, a Hindu, and a... Buddhist, is it? Who's the fifth one? Did I mention all of them? Sixth one?
I don't know.
I mean, it seemed pretty explosive. You know, it seemed like a pretty dramatic scenario.
Is this the kind of thing you usually do?
No, I usually do dramatic features. I got involved with this because I met Keith Jennings on another project. And when
Keith Lowell Jensen.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
that's what Keith we call him. We call him Keith Lowell Jensen.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah. But Keith became a friend and he told me about the tour and I thought that... given the tenor of religious conflict and strife in this country and in the world, it seemed really intriguing, the idea of getting six people together from different faiths in a communal atmosphere. And the one I assume there'll be a certain amount of ragging on each other, which is part of the show. But I think ultimately it's conciliatory, which is nice.
Mike, is there some ragging on each other?
There's plenty of ragging because they're all wrong. come on. Jesus is here right now.
So, Larry, what are you doing? Are you making a documentary about Coexist? Or are you making, basically a film of the stage show?
Well, it kind of straddles the line. We're shooting the show, but I want it to be more than simply like a special that you might see about a performance. I want to do background interviews and how the thing got together, interview the comedians separately, interview people going in and coming out, and give it a filmy kind of a feel.
And then what are you going to do with it?
Well, we do what we normally do with independent films is you go to film festivals, you see if you can find distribution, and I just think it's topical, it's interesting, and it's very timely.
You met Keith through atheism. You're
correct.
Also making a documentary about atheism. I understand you're also in town working on that
right.
film. You're going to be interviewing someone right after our show, philosophy professor.
Absolutely. I'm running right across campus to interview him.
What exactly is the film about?
Well, atheism, if you listen to some voices certainly on the Christian right, but in religious community, the perception is that atheists are taking over the country, the war against Christmas, you hear this phrase all the time. And from atheist perspective, they feel like they're a beleaguered minority. And I'm curious about what the real implications of the atheist movement are, and on a personal level, why somebody would become an atheist, and philosophical level, why, how do you deal with some of the problems that, that all humans have had to dealt with without the concept of a, of an overriding moral framework that you get from a religion or a god. I think it's an intriguing topic, and I think it's very timely.
Mike.
Yeah, now is a good time to become an atheist because of the economy, and that's what they're trying to do. They're like, let's eliminate Christmas because, you know, the recession's up.
So, yeah. I guess it's cheaper if you don't celebrate Christmas. It's cheaper in the current economy.
You save a couple of dollars. No. I see what Larry's saying.
Well, atheists certainly have crappier holidays.
Right.
You know, I was just at the lighting of the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center yesterday or 2 days ago, and I couldn't get anywhere near it.
Oh, so you were in New York just 2 days ago?
I just flew in for this. And I could not get within a block of the tree because there's so many people. Now, clearly it's a secular holiday as well as a religious holiday. But there is I think atheists deal with how to create a sense of community, how to a sense of reverence. And that's missing from atheist philosophy. So they have to find other ways to do that. And that's one of the things I'm curious about as well.
Now, speaking of New York City, Mike E. Winfield, you are on Comedy Central's Live at Gotham tonight.
Tonight at 8 on the West Coast.
As if Coexist Comedy Tour wasn't big enough time, you're on Comedy Central.
You know, I try. That's what us Christians do. You know, we find love for everyone and we spread it as much as we can.
What are you doing in Live at Gotham? I assume it's already taped and edited.
Right. I did it in New York. I'm performing live stand-up. And it's a good show. I'm actually the last comedian on the show, which is a great slot. You know, it's almost like headliner, you know. And I was just able to do a new experience. I've never been on Comedy Central before.
Were you nervous?
You know what? I've done other TV and I've worked out nerves and other things before. And now this was like the one I was excited to do. And I'm actually excited to see it. Because a lot of times I give up before it's about to air anything else I've done. And I'm like, man, I don't want to see this. I don't want anyone to see it.
Do you know who the audience was? Was it New
people.
Yorkers? Was it New was it New Yorkers or was it tourists from Iowa?
No, I don't think the Iowans made it. It was everyone was from New York.
Yeah.
Right.
A Christian in New York. And
yeah.
He survived it.
Larry, you've made quite a few varied films over the years, including you were one of the writers of Halloween Resurrection.
Yeah. I'm not sure that you want to mention that publicly.
Because?
Well, you know, when you work in on Hollywood movies, they tend to not always come out exactly the way you expect that they should or would.
Oh, so this one did not turn out the way you anticipated?
Well, when you're a writer, you really are at the mercy of the producers and the director. And I thought the film... well, one of the reasons I'm...
It was amazing, Larry.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Well, we unkilled off Jamie Lee Curtis, or rather, we unkilled off Michael Moore, and we did kill off Jamie Lee Curtis, who is really dead. I can tell the audience that much, that she will not be back. One of the reasons I'm doing a little independent movie like the one I'm working on with Mike and with Keith is because it just gives you a lot more freedom and a lot more creative satisfaction.
Yeah. And Mike, what do you think's next for you? Do you know?
What's next besides fame from Coexist?
Extreme fortune.
Exactly. I don't know. I'm on a college tour too. Well, not necessarily a college tour, but I'm working a lot of colleges and just staying busy because this is what I'm trying to do is just be on stage and enlighten lives. And that's why I want people to come and see the show because it's nothing like a live comedy show. It's like when you watch the baseball game on TV. It's not the same as being in the stands.
Sure.
And when you're there... It's where it happens.
Yeah, when you see the show tomorrow night, you'll get to be in a movie too. Let's not forget that.
That's true.
Yeah.
Coexist Comedy Tour at the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento. Tomorrow night, Saturday night, one of the comedians is Mike E. Winfield. He's a Christian. .com. Mike E. Winfield is one of the comedians. He's a Christian in the group. If you're not familiar, there are comedians from various religious faiths and an atheist. And in town is the filmmaker Larry Brand, who's making a documentary about the Coexist Comedy Tour. Mike, Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Gregory Vojda, the young Hungarian who's a new conductor of music in the mountains. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. This year, Music in the Mountains had to do something for the first time in its 30-year history, hire a new conductor. That's because the Grass Valley-based music festival had been led from the start by co-founder Paul Perry. Over 100 people applied for the job, which went to Gregory Vajda, a young Hungarian conductor, clarinetist, and composer. This weekend, Vajda conducts the Music in the Mountains holiday choral concerts, and he joins us. Gregory Vajda, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Well, it was a long process, Music in the Mountains, choosing a conductor. A lot of people applied for the job. It must have been a good feeling when they gave you a call and said, you're the man.
Well, I jokingly like to call this the longest music director search in music history, which is not true. It's not an unusual time frame for a search like this. And indeed, it's a great honor to be here and be on board and to work with Music in the Mountains.
Why does it take so long, oftentimes, to choose a new conductor for an orchestra?
Well, there are several rounds. First, you want to get the biggest pool, and then narrow it down, and then once you have your finalists, as we did it last season here, they actually very graciously shared the whole season and gave the two of us many opportunities to prove ourselves. So I think if it's too long, it's not good, but it's too short, you can't really make sure that you're picking the right person.
It must be a slightly unusual situation to be in when you are not only a guest conductor, but you are a candidate to become the conductor, and there's another guy who's in exactly the same situation. How do you handle the musicians when they know that you're not just any old guest conductor, you're also auditioning for the job?
Well, I don't really have a different style for conducting when I'm part of a search or conducting when I'm a guest conductor anyway. And I do that a lot. So I'm the resident conductor of the Oregon Symphony in Portland, but I travel a lot. And as we call it in the music world, I'm doing many gigs outside of my my main job. So it's not an unusual situation for me. And I'm just working on the music when I'm there. The only difference probably is to try to show what you can do with programming and how you present a concert to the audience. That is a little different when you were in a search.
Yeah, I was just looking at your schedule, and you're in Portland with the Oregon Symphony in late November, late December. You're in Grass Valley right now with Music in the Mountains. You're with the Seattle Symphony in early December, and you're also going to be in Hungary in late January conducting an opera. That's a remarkable travel schedule.
It is, yes. That's welcome to my life. You know, that's kind of conductor's life. They're over the map.
My guest is Gregory Vajda. He's artistic director and conductor of Music in the Mountains Festival. They have holiday choral concerts this weekend, starting tonight and also Saturday and Sunday afternoons. Last year, you had the chance to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic, which is certainly one of and maybe the top orchestras in the world. Could you tell us how that happened and what it was like?
Well, I was part of this production and the Salzburg Festival, out of the four performances I conducted, the last one, I had to step in. It was part of my contract that I'm ready to conduct the performance, and indeed it happened. And I got to tell you, Vienna Philharmonic is nothing like you see it on pictures. You might have a mental picture of them being just this very old, traditional, probably not very nice group of old European men, and it's not true at all anymore. They're a very young group and very responsive and very nice, and I did an old Bartok program with them, and they were very, very responsive, and we just had a great time.
Yeah. Now, you are also, in addition to being a conductor, you're a clarinetist. I haven't heard of many clarinetists who went on to become conductors.
Well, actually, Minnesota Orchestra's music director, he was a clarinet. So there are probably two or three out there of that type of conductor. And it is not unusual to have a career as an instrumentalist, but you're right. Most of them are pianists first or violin players. That's the most common.
And you're also a composer. How much composing do you do?
Well, as much as I can and as much time as I can find. This year I have two commissions, both of them from Portland, Oregon. There are two groups that play contemporary music there. And so one premiere is going to be happening at the end of January while I'm conducting in Hungary, and the other one is in May. So I'm working on the second piece right now.
Is there any chance that Music in the Mountains will feature one of your compositions?
Yes. If I can convince myself as artistic director to program my own piece, then yes, we'll do that in the future. But of course, it's not enough just for that piece just to be good. I got to fit into the season. You know, I'm thinking now in creating and constructing a season that stands on its feet. And that's what I did with 2010. So this is the first time that Music in the Mountains actually has a season calendar laid out for the entire 2010 year.
I haven't heard your own compositions, but I do know that Music in the Mountains doesn't do out there avant-garde music. Does the kind of music you write, would that fit in with Music in the Mountains?
I would think so. Well, first of all, every piece I write is a little bit different. Second is that we have Wet Ink, which is the Nevada County Composers Cooperative, that is part of Summerfest every year. So this is kind of a tradition. Kronos Quartet is coming this next summer, and
really?
playing for Terry Riley's birthday, actually. So there is some so-called avant-garde or new music. I prefer to call it new music.
Yes. Now, I've read that you've added lots of brass, organ, and percussion to the 2009 concerts of Music in the Mountains. Was that not a big feature of Music in the Mountains in the past, those kinds of instrumental sounds?
Well, I think that just jazzing it up a little bit is just good for the holiday feeling, you know. The Festival Chorale is doing these concerts traditionally every year, and this year I just felt that we first of all should put a little extra sound and extra attraction there, and we are also inviting three high school choirs to sing with us. So every day we have a guest chorus of young people singing along and doing their own song as well.
I read that the choir conductor is Ryan Murray, who's a relatively recent music graduate of Sacramento State, and he's also the music director of the Townsend Opera Players in Modesto. Ryan Murray seems to be getting off to a pretty good start in his career.
Ryan is great, and I knew of his hiring before I came here, but it was kind of before my times, but it's just a great fit. We can work together great, and he's so talented, and he's just excellent with our chorus members, and he's a great musician too.
Gregory Vojdas, new conductor of Music in the Mountains. You're from Hungary. How did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States when I was 29, so it's been 7 years now, and I got a job with the Milwaukee Symphony in Wisconsin. I was assistant conductor there, so I came over here for a job. Before that, I was a freelance in Europe doing conducting, composing, and clarinet playing, and I worked for a summer festival. I worked for a drama theater as a music director, so I did all kinds of different things, that decision coming to the United States and kind of restarting my career was an important one.
And the holiday choral concerts this weekend, what kind of music can people expect? Is it classical music, or is it going to be more traditional holiday-style music?
Well, the core of it is traditional holiday music, but you also get to hear Loridsen's O Magnum Mysterium, which is a beautiful contemporary piece, contemporary as far as 1943 is contemporary, but 20th century. We have Shalom Chaverim on the program, which is a beautiful Israeli folk song put into a chorus. And I'm going to conduct also a sing-along, the Hallelujah Chorus, which is among the favorites, of course, and there's a little Mendelssohn piece on the program. But other than that, it starts and ends with the best-known Christmas carols.
Gregory Vojda of Music in the Mountains. They got three holiday choral concerts this weekend, tonight at 7:30, Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 2 at the Nevada County Fairgrounds in Grass Valley. Gregory Vojda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Insight. That's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Mara Ponce. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. At Insight, we have one goal.
That's an interest. I've never been asked that question before.
Good.
Very good question.
That is such a good question.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That is such a great question.
That's a really good question.
From scientists, lawmakers, artists, interesting people of every stripe.
Boy, you have really uncorked Pandora's box with that with that question.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 o'clock on Capital Public Radio.